The Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favorite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. R.D. Dyckman, or Richard David Dyckman, is a theoretical physicist, research scientist, and father of a type 1 diabetic son. RD has also started up the very popular Facebook page called Type 1 Grit, which is dedicated to sharing the information for type 1 diabetics and creating a community for people to share their success stories. RD, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast today. And I'm really excited about this because for me, this is something that I want to learn more about, and I'm sure our listeners do, especially around type 1 diabetes, and also for people that have never heard of actually what is type 1 diabetes and the difference between type 2. So can we start there? What is type 1 diabetes and how does it differ from type 2?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition, and basically what happens is the immune system starts attacking the beta cells, which are the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. And after a series of autoimmune attacks, which occur over a period of a year or maybe even longer, the body is no longer able to create enough insulin to metabolize food. Mm-hmm. And typically what will happen is a person, if the immune system attack is not somehow recognized, the blood sugars will start rising and a person can actually suffer fatal, what is called diabetic ketoacidosis, if they're not able to be properly diagnosed by their medical team. So it's especially during diagnosis, you are facing a very dangerous situation when you are no longer able to produce any insulin.
And how does this differ then from type 2 diabetes?
Right. Now, type 2 diabetes is a totally different condition. Type 2 diabetes occurs when probably has no autoimmune component to it, but it generally is what we know about it is that it occurs when someone's ability basically to metabolize carbohydrate goes away due to insulin resistance. And the insulin resistance seems to be occurring when the body is no longer able to store fat properly in the adipose, and fat starts getting stored inside the organs, and insulin resistance goes up. The body starts producing a lot of insulin to try to keep blood sugars down, and eventually the person becomes diabetic. The A1Cs get very high. And if it's not treated, the beta cell mass can actually die after a while, and you can end up with the same type of situation with type 1 diabetes where the person becomes insulin dependent and insulin, exogenous insulin dependent. And that's kind of what you're trying to avoid. You're trying to, with a type 2 diabetic, diagnose and treat the disease because it is reversible, especially in the early stages, unlike type 1 diabetes.
So let me ask you this question, because it seems to be, as you said, it's an autoimmune disease, or you have an autoimmune response. Why does it seem to type 1 happen to children more so, would I be correct, than adults? Or is it across the board that it doesn't matter, age, it's not age dependent?
Right. It seems to be that type 1 is mostly a disease that we hear about being diagnosed early in children. But it's not necessarily the case. There are a significant number of type 1s that are diagnosed as adults. In fact, many type 1s are, in adulthood are falsely diagnosed as type 2s because of the high A1Cs. Why the autoimmune strikes in children, or why it's rising, there's a lot of puzzles. It's, you know, we know that type 1 is rising. I think type 1 is rising in both children and adults. It's not clear as to whether those are environmental factors, dietary factors, something that we don't know about. But the rise in type 1 diabetes is certainly significant and newsworthy.
We're going to go through some of the early signs and what a diagnosis looks like. And then I want to get into your story in a few questions down the track. But let's talk about what is the process for diagnosis. So if you're a parent, and what are the warning signs, or what are the triggers out there that you might look for to go to the doctor, and potentially this could be type 1 diabetes for your child or for yourself?
Yeah, right. So the biggie that is you'll hear often, and actually didn't occur in our situation, was nighttime bedwetting, or a lot of going to the bathroom late at night. And that's primarily because the blood sugars get so high that they're very dehydrating, and the child or the adult becomes extremely thirsty and drinking a lot of water. Hunger can also be exasperated because you're not getting the fuel is not getting to your body. You're essentially peeing out all your dietary calories that you're eating. Lethargy, when you're running these high blood sugars, which are can be 5, 10, even 10 times normal when before you're diagnosed, you can be extremely wiped out. So that was definitely the case for my son David, who was a substantially good athlete and was failing in athletics for 3 or 4 months before he was diagnosed. Those are some of the typical warning signs. The thirst is a biggie. Unusual thirst, especially late at night. That's something that I've heard almost universally cited as a symptom.
So you discovered this with your child at the, how old was he at the time?
No, he was 9 when he was diagnosed. Yeah.
So tell us about the story about what happens next. Obviously, you're concerned. You've got so many questions. You go to the doctor. What unfolded for you, and what unfolds for most people? And I want to get into your own journey and how you have become in this position where you have become a voice for a different approach to type 1 diabetes. But let's take us through the initial doctor's visit and the subsequent information they shared with you, and then the results of that information, please.
Right. The story is very familiar to any parent who's been had a child that's been diagnosed. But at some point, there's along the line, things rapidly differentiated from normal. So the normal part was that we had our son. As I said before, you know, excels at sports. Suddenly he became very fatigued, not doing well in sports. Teacher commented that he had his head on his desk for some time. We thought he was going through some kind of growing phase. It was our first child. So, you know, it's a very confusing time. And we took him to the doctor several times. The doctor said, well, maybe he had a flu and he should be trying to feed him. The doctor even suggested that we give him some milkshakes to try to give him extra calories, since he was losing weight. by the way, losing weight is another big symptom. And what happened was he didn't get better. And we kind of had the straw that broke the camel's back. One day he was home from school and I was watching him and we were watching a show on TV and he was hungry and I gave him something to eat and he threw up. And, it was such a confusing time. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And, I said, let's get you into the bathroom to get cleaned up. He said, I can't get off the couch. And so I picked him up off the couch and, I never forget, Pete, man, I picked him up and he was light as a feather. And I felt, you know, I could feel his ribs through the back of his shirt when I lifted him off the couch. And, I took him into the bathroom and we took a shirt off to get him cleaned up. And I looked at him and he was like skin and bones. He was like a skeletal figure. And I probably hadn't seen him with the shirt off for 3 or 4 days. And that's how fast things happen. And he probably lost 15 pounds in 2 or 3 days. And, wow. I called my wife and she said, what's going on? I said, I think Dave's going to die. Something's wrong. And so we took him to the emergency room and the doctor still was pushing the milkshakes, but, we got her to agree to some laboratory work. And as soon as we did the labs and went home, she called us and she said, you have to come to the hospital immediately. Mm-hmm. And we went to the emergency room and there was maybe like, it seemed like 300 people in this small room. I mean, it was overflowing and we thought, oh God, you know, this is going to be 10 hours before we, and as soon as we signed in, the double doors opened and 10 people came out with a bullhorn, you know, calling for David. And it was a surreal experience because we knew something had to have been wrong with him to jump in front of all these people in line. Anyhow, that was kind of the initial diagnosis, and that was a severe diagnosis, and he was probably, you know, within 24 hours of dying. But wow. After that, this is where the story sort of diverges because, you know, my wife and I were both, you know, fairly educated people, but we knew nothing about diabetes. I mean, nothing. And so, you know, of course, we immediately start trying to learn as much as possible. And our endocrinologist, or Dave's new endocrinologist, came in the next day to basically give Dave a crash course on how to treat his diabetes. And and he pulled no punches with Dave. He told Dave, carbohydrate makes your blood sugar go up and insulin makes your blood sugar go down. And if your blood sugar goes too high, you can suffer the consequences of complications of diabetes, which include blindness and loss of limb. And, wow. And if you go too low, you can pass out. So you're going to be in this position where you're going to have to balance your blood sugar with insulin and food.
That's a lot for a 9-year-old.
Yeah. Well, the good news there was that Dave and the endocrinologist, he was a graduate of David's school and they kind of hit it off a little bit. So he recognized that Dave was a pretty sharp guy. And anyway, Dave's reaction to hearing all that was that he said, well, I just won't eat any carbohydrate then. And my reaction was to laugh at Dave and the doctor giggled too. And we said, well, no, you need carbohydrate for energy.
Mm.
And, you know, I remember him saying that because it was interesting, but I didn't make any impression on me. And
smart kid.
Yeah, right. Well, it is funny because it tells you how simple the solution is. You know, even a little kid can just go right for it. The problem was we then met with the dietitian and it was a typical meeting with the dietitian where she said all the myths. Now you get all the myths, Pete. This is when you get all the myths that your kids need carbohydrate for their brain and they need carbohydrate to grow and they need carbohydrate so that they can take their insulin. And so we got a diet that is very typical. It's a low fat, lots of grain, emphasis on meals and snacks that contain lots of carbohydrates, skim milk, oatmeal, exactly the wrong kind of thing that you should be feeding a child, let alone a type 1 child.
But you started on this, didn't you?
Well, we didn't have any idea. You know, I knew there had to be something to it, right? So I blindly followed along. And what we did was we went home and we did dutifully follow the program. And Dave's blood sugars were ranging from very low to triple, quadruple, and five times what a normal non-diabetic kid would have, up and down all day long. And I figured out after about a week that doing carefully recording of data and, I work as a physicist, so it was a very natural thing for me to do, to try to build computer modeling and of what was happening with the insulin and glucose. And after maybe a week or 2 weeks, I figured out that there was no clear pattern. Everything was random, or stochastic, as you would say. The combination of carbohydrate and injected insulin generated complete chaos, and I knew that we were in big trouble.
So how did that make you feel as a parent, and I guess
terrified,
communicating this with your son as well?
I was terrified because at the same time I was doing research on what the complications of high blood sugar would lead to. And not only that, I had reached out right away to a community of other scientists and engineers who had type 1 kids and had seen their blood sugar traces, and they had been at it a lot longer than I had, and the results were also bad. Blood sugars all over the place. I mean, it's sort of a living hell to be in this situation.
It's a roller coaster, and I guess that affects mood. It affects every function of the body, doesn't it?
You're totally wiped out. He was so wiped out already from being sick, and he immediately put on a diet, which does nothing but secure more agony. And and he even looked at me. This, you know, he was, I mean, you lose 15 pounds on a little kid, it's not easy to recover that kind of weight. He looked at me and he said, "You got to get this oatmeal out of my face. You know, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, we're trying to figure out how to do it, you know." And of course, you know, right away we give a break would be to give him a few eggs for breakfast. And his blood sugars would be, you know, pretty normal. I mean, and I said, "No, you can't have eggs every day. You've got to eat oatmeal," because that's what the dietitian said. Well, yep. My wife, now, you know, we gave Dave some credit for figuring out that he doesn't need carbohydrate. Next comes my wife, who she said, you know, there's got to be something more to this thing here. And she started Googling low carb and type 1 diabetes, and up pops Dr. Bernstein's name. Now, this is a month after the diagnosis. She ordered the book. We looked at the records, and I got the Bernstein book a couple days after she ordered it.
And it's called The Diabetes Solution, isn't it?
Yeah, it's called Diabetes Solution. It's the most important book on, and notice it doesn't say type 1 diabetes. It says diabetes. So there's, you can treat your diabetes with this book, whether you're type 1 or type 2. This is the Bible for diabetes treatment. There's not a topic in diabetes management that's not covered in this book.
And Dr. Bernstein has type 1 diabetes himself. For how many years has he had this?
Yeah, he was diagnosed about the same age as Dave. He's 84 now. He was originally a theoretical physicist and switched to engineering, and then his diabetes got so bad that he was pretty much had terminal kidney disease, and was loaded with complications of diabetes. He couldn't control his diabetes. And what he did was he discovered the first blood sugar meter that was available. Only doctors could buy it, but he figured out a way to buy it. And he started experimenting with his blood sugar and food. And he found out that what he had been told, which was to eat breads and sweet foods and you know, the sort of the same kind of stuff that's being told for people to eat now, low fat, high carb. Mm-hmm. He found out that these were the foods that he should be avoiding. And just by checking his blood sugar meter and doing trial and error. So he figured out how not just the foods that you have to eat, but how to cover those foods with insulin. Because you still need to cover insulin, protein with insulin. Mm-hmm. And you still need to cover your veggies with insulin. So there's a whole art of that. And what happened was his diabetic complications reversed, his gastroparesis reversed, his kidney disease reversed. He started feeling much better. He was able to perform muscle building exercises. And now he's 84 years old and he still practices medicine. He still has his own clinic. And he shows no signs of, I mean, he's still, I just talked to him today. He is, he sounds like a young, eager graduate student.
I love it.
No signs of slowing down.
And I guess his book would have resonated with you being a physicist as well.
That's right.
So who read it first, you or your wife, or you read it together?
She bought the book and it came in the mail and I started reading the first section, which is on Bernstein's law of small numbers. And when I read it, I realized that what he was saying in the book was exactly what my computer models had shown, that large doses of injected insulin matched with large doses of carbohydrate do not yield the predictable result. You get chaos. Hmm. But if you use small doses of insulin and small doses of carbohydrate, then you get predictability, and predictability is the whole ball game when you're doing, when you're dealing with type 1 or any insulin dependent diabetic. And there's a physics explanation of why injecting insulin requires you to eat a low carbohydrate diet. And this was what I found in the book, and this is what my models had reflected. And I became so incredibly elated. It was the most elating moment of my life because I knew we had found our way out of this mess. And we implemented the book in all its details. And it takes time because there's a lot to it. And after 3 months, you get immediate success, Pete. I mean, the next day, the blood sugars calm down. And then as you fine-tune the results, by 6 months, we were home free. And Dave's A1Cs have been below 5.0% ever since. I just ran an A1C of Dave's just an hour ago because we're back from this big basketball tournament in Las Vegas. And it was 4.7%, which is the same as his brother's and the same as mine, by the way.
Wow.
So the Bernstein book has allowed Dave to be healthier than his non-diabetic friends, which is amazing. It's amazing. It is amazing.
Well, it's a testament to you as parents, you and your wife and your whole family and to your sons, but also to Dr. Bernstein for working this out. And I'll never forget this. And your story echoes very much of my own journey because I first heard of Dr. Bernstein about 7 or 8 years ago when my wife, Nicola, and I owe this to her, she picked up a book called Primal Body, Primal Mind by the author and now dear friend, Nora Gagaudis. And she quotes Dr. Bernstein in there saying that there is no dietary or human need to have carbohydrates in the diet. And that really struck me. You said there's essential proteins, essential amino acids, or essential fats, but we don't really, there's no literature in any textbook that says carbohydrates are an essential part of a human diet. And I read the whole book and we adopted those principles. And 7 or 8 years later, we're still applying those principles of a lower carbohydrate, healthier fat approach. So let's talk about carbohydrates and what they are and why are they so promoted in current dietary advice?
Yeah, that is a question that immediately when I talked to my friends, they said, well, why is he being told to eat carbohydrates in the first place? You know, they sort of have the same reaction that Dave had. Well, just don't eat carbohydrates. Well, you know, and I think people are really catching on now that these myths about cholesterol poisoning, cholesterol being the chief agent of heart disease, carbohydrate is the primary fuel for the body. All of these myths sort of really took hold in the 1970s and 1980s. And what's interesting is that not only has the disaster since ensued with the general population, we know that the result of these myths has led to a skyrocketing chaos of metabolic problems in the general population. Everything from obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, all these diseases. You know, I'm 49. You never really heard about these things when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. They're all now the type 1 diabetics are not just along for the ride, but they are the ones who suffer the most, the fastest, because these principles, which were never true in the first place, are applied to type 1 kids from diagnosis, and they're immediately sent down the tubes. These low-fat, high-carb guidelines, they mathematically secure diabetic complications from already close to diagnosis. We know that kids have immediate damage to the developing brain. They will quickly develop problems properly digesting food because of neuropathies in the vagus nerve. Something like 80% of all children have, type 1 children have detectable retinopathy by 15 years after diagnosis. So if you're diagnosed at the age of 8, by the time you're just able to drive, you're likely to have retinopathy.
Which is?
Retinopathy is when you have black spots in your vision because you have veins in your retina that are basically popping. Mm. So there's over 100 complications of diabetes, and these type 1 kids are taking the brunt of the bad food guidelines, the incorrect food guidelines. And I'm seeing some signs that things are changing. When Dave was diagnosed at age 9, 5 years ago, if you went out into the social media and said, my child has normal blood sugars and he's on a low carbohydrate diet, you could look out the window within an hour and your house would be surrounded with crazy people with pitchforks and torches. And in the crowds would be doctors, dietitians, and Professional Diabetes Association board members. Now, what we see are people starting to catch on. If you go into social media now, if you say my son's on a low carb diet and has normal blood sugars, you'll see someone will reply, "Yes, my child is too, or I am too," and they'll take a graph, their screenshot of their CGM graph, their continuous glucose monitor graph, proving that their blood sugars are normal. And So through social media, not through the professional diabetes associations or the doctors, but through social media, we're seeing a sort of a rise that the truth is finally getting out. These Bernstein concepts are getting out. And this has really been my focus since we got Dave's blood sugar normalized, was to promote this life-changing, life-saving idea. And it's really taken off.
Well, let me ask you this question, because I already know the answer to it, but a lot of people might be getting, I guess, the wrong idea here. This is not a cure, is it? We just need to make that clear. But what is this for your son and for other type 1 diabetics?
Well, it's not a cure. In fact, the amount of work that goes into securing Dave's normal blood sugars is intense. Because he's an athlete and because he's in puberty and eating so much food, it makes the problem even more difficult. But essentially through a 24/7 sort of ambient kind of monitoring of Dave's blood sugars, he's able to stay in non-diabetic ranges 99% of the time, which are between, okay, let's say 4 and 6 millimoles, or 75 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. But he still has to inject insulin for every piece of food that he eats, even if it's low carb or no carb. You still need insulin to metabolize protein. He still has to inject insulin to cover his fasting state, which is called basal insulin. And to do those things, to get the blood sugars that we're getting, require a lot of fundamental understanding of how to use insulin. And these are the things that you're going to learn in the Bernstein book. And you can't learn them anywhere else. I took a challenge to produce on an index card a number of different principles required to keep Dave's blood sugars in line. And I went through the book and I wrote down 15 different concepts. Now, there's a lot more stuff in the book. There's stuff on foot care and there's stuff on treating hypothyroidism and so on. But just for keeping your blood sugars normal as an insulin-dependent diabetic. And I wrote them on an index card, and we have it, you know, it's all over the social media now. Those things require a lot of work, first of all. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's also interesting, if you go through the list, probably 13 or 14 out of the 15 things are taught incorrectly and nearly opposite by the standard treatments that you'll learn, you know, from doctors and dietitians. So if you're trying to normalize your blood sugars based on what you're typically being told by a doctor and dietitian, which are something like eat all the carbohydrate you want and just take insulin, just count the carbs and take insulin, you'll never get normal blood sugars. It's sort of this physics-based approach that Bernstein discusses in his book that's what allows for you to keep this kind of exquisite blood sugar control.
I've interviewed other people on the podcast that have helped their own autoimmune illness and disease, such as Dr. Terry Walls talking about her MS. And do you see, and she promotes quite a similar approach, which is a low carb, healthy fat.
Very similar, yeah.
Very similar. And also Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, the paleo mum, she talks about autoimmune and how to address it. So the question for you is, what have you seen across the board for other people with autoimmune issues that are following Dr. Bernstein's approach? Or is this just specific for type 1? Or can it go across the board for other autoimmune? And can it go across the board for all humans? Is this the preferred way of eating? I'd love your understanding of this, because from what I understand, your whole family, including your other son, eats this way as well now.
Well, that's right. So what I would say, we all eat a low-carb diet to support Dave. So the families that I see succeeding are all supporting their child. If you have one child who's eating low-carb and the rest are able to eat the cookie and cakes and store-bought processed food, it's not going to work. So we all do that. So then the question is, well, let's take the individuals in my family. We have our youngest son, Hayden. He's much more susceptible to getting type 1 than David is. Now, Bernstein would say it's not just essential for Hayden to support Dave and eat low carb. It's likely that he's playing with fire. Because he's more susceptible to type 1. What we know is that type 1 starts and it goes in stages. And if Hayden is more susceptible because has a sibling with type 1, by eating carbohydrate and provoking hypersecretion of insulin from the beta cells, it is likely that you are going to inflame the autoimmune response by doing that. So we watch Hayden's blood sugars periodically, and his blood sugars are normal, and we make sure that we don't provoke any kind of autoimmune response from Hayden It's no guarantee. We don't understand that that's the cure-all or that's the cure-all prevention. But that's one reason we keep Hayden's diet the same as his brother's. Then you move on to the parents, and the both Roxanne and I grew up eating the high carb processed food. We're of that generation. And when Dave was diagnosed, we were both, my wife wasn't, but I was significantly overweight and not in good shape. Certainly not able to do any kind of athletics in a serious way. And I'll tell you what, as soon as I started on this low carb diet to support Dave, I never felt so much better. And in my life, I've lost probably about 50 pounds from my maximum, but not just the loss of weight, the muscle gain that I got from learning how to work out correctly and the vitality that I have. It's been a remarkable personal journey, and it's been a real silver lining. We're a close-knit family. It's been a silver lining for Dave to see his parents both get significantly healthier. You know, and his little brother, we took the little brother to his first swim competition, and they were feeding all the kids Doritos before their races to give them carb energy. If you can believe that, Pete.
I believe it.
We all laughed, and my youngest son, he beat, and his first swim meet beat everybody in every race that he ran. So, you know, it's there's so many benefits across the board of eating this way. And what are we eating? We're eating a variety of protein foods, a variety of vegetables, and the occasional low-carb treat. That's it. We're avoiding grains and sugars and processed food. It's a whole foods diet. And because Dave's type 1, we remove things like underground vegetables, like potatoes and all that. But basically, it's just a healthy diet, like that grandma, before we were perverted into thinking that we should be drinking skim milk and eating cereal for breakfast. It's just what my grandma would have fed me, eggs and bacon.
So going to the question, does he eat eggs most days? Or do you eat eggs most days?
We eat as many eggs as possible. we thumb our noses at the idea that omelets are poisonous and to diabetics, and they should be eating grain and skim milk. And there is no cholesterol poisoning. That's not the reason why diabetics are dying of heart disease. It's because of the chronic high blood sugars. So we eat eggs for breakfast, and we eat, like Dave likes waffles for breakfast, but we make them out of almond flour.
Yeah,
and they're delicious. So he has a healthy nut based almond flours. He has some eggs. He has some bacon for lunch. He'll have a little salad and some meat. And for dinner, he might have a steak or some fish. And he'll have we tend to rotate in a variety of vegetables. So he gets all the calories he needs. He gets all the protein he needs. He gets all the micronutrients he needs. And he gets the normal blood sugars. So guess what? He's 6 feet tall. He's, you know, 14 years old. He plays sports every day. He's doing great.
And you're not depriving, are you, and at all as far as food goes?
Well, this is the big lie that's pushed on the kids and the families. Oh, the poor kid, he won't be like all the other kids. Well, first of all, the other kids aren't doing so well. The non-diabetic kids are being turned into type 2 diabetics at an early age now. Obesity is rampant among children. And it's, by the way, it's also rampant now amongst type 1 children. So you don't want to look at that group and say, well, we want to be like that group, because that group is not doing well and it's getting worse fast. And the kids know it, by the way. This is not some research paper. The kids can see it. They can see, especially a type 1 kid who knows a little something about food, they see what their mates are eating and they see what their bodies are doing. And this idea that kids are just mindlessly going to eat junk and not care about their bodies and just go straight down the tubes with bad blood sugars and that we should support that is ridiculous. What I see amongst kids is I see lots of kids playing sports big emphasis on sports amongst kids. Lots of emphasis among kids to study and to get into university. I don't know any kid who's, if you said, who wants to raise your hand if you want to go down the tubes? I don't know any kid that's going to raise their hand. But mm-hmm. But with the type 1 kids, what happens is they're put on this regimen of essentially it just generates agony. And then they lose hope. You know, the parents and the dietitians and the physicians point their fingers at them and say, oh, you're not doing it right and your blood sugars are too high. And well, if you're in that kind of situation, you're just going to say, well, forget it. I'm going to just, you know, since I'm so unhealthy anyway, I'm going to just do what I want to do. And you're going to embrace negative behaviors. But the kids that we know who are following this low carb, normal blood sugar thing, they don't go back. They're all ecstatic. And we've shown that in the data, by the way. We have a new study with Duke University that, and we didn't talk about this type 1 grit group, but we can start now. Mm. The kids and the adults who have changed and are following the diet, the quality of life metrics are through the roof. My life has changed forever. I can finally control my blood sugars. I feel so much better. My neuropathies are healing. I can feel myself digesting my food better. You know, it's like a miracle to people. So they don't go back. And the idea that, you know, they would rather be eating junk food, but they're not allowed to is sort of ridiculous. You eat some junk food when you're a type 1 diabetic, you go to 400, you feel like misery for the rest of the day.
So you've set up the Facebook page Type 1 Grit for anyone that's listening that can go and see the results and see what's happening, because you have people from all over the world that are contributing data and contributing their own anecdotal stories to this page. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. We initially, I went out into social media and initially gravitated towards parent groups, and the parent groups are, you should check one out. It's just nonstop misery, what's happening to the kids. But I decided to try to find, just like with the Bernstein book, we found a few small groups, mostly of adults, of people who were controlling their blood sugars. And guess what they were doing? They were all doing the same thing. Even the little kids, one or two little kids we would find, they were all eating a low carbohydrate diet. They were all using insulin in essentially the same way that Bernstein discusses in the book. They were all doing things opposite what their physicians and dietitians were telling them to do. They were all eating healthy whole foods instead of all this processed crackers and cookies and jellies and cakes that they were being told to eat, and the skim milk and the low fat meat and all that kind of nonsense. And so what we did was, we started another group sort of based on that Bernstein principle, and the group grew and grew and grew and grew. And it grew to the point where after we had a couple thousand people, and we had some doctors in the group too, type 1 doctors who are, of course, the type 1 doctors are following the Bernstein, you know, they have real skin in the game. Mm-hmm. And we started a research group with some folks from Harvard, David Ludwig, Bernstein's in the group. I'm in the research group, and we just had an article published in Pediatrics, which basically demonstrates what's happening in this cohort, which is exceptional glycemic control, never seen before in a group of type 1 diabetics. Average A1C, 5.5%. Average blood glucose around 5.5 millimoles, about 100 or so milligrams per deciliter. These numbers are so drastically better than what's seen in standard care. So it's really shaken up the type 1 world that people are able to achieve these kind of blood sugars.
It's interesting because at the moment there's more and more media coming out sharing this information in Australia and New Zealand, in the States and Canada, and it's fantastic. And I nearly feel like the type 1 diabetic movement that you and Dr. Bernstein have created is actually going to be the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, of how to change the guidelines for everybody. And do you feel that?
I definitely feel it. It's a big sea change going on right now. And you're seeing it in social media. The physicians and dietitians are still, for whatever reason, and it's really sad, and they've got their heels dug in. And there are still doctors who are banging their, they're flying all over the world to conferences and banging their fists on the table and saying, you have to eat carbohydrate or you'll, your brain will dissolve or your bones won't grow. There's some guy, I think he's in New Zealand or Australia, who went to this scientific convention in Florida, sponsored by the American Diabetes Association, just trying to scare everyone into eating as much carbohydrate as possible. But it's just, no one believes it anymore. They all know that the game's over. The diabetics can see with their own eyes what people are eating. It's obviously healthy food. I mean, there's no way around it. And the blood sugars are right there. You can go on social media, see pictures of the food next to the CGM graphs, next to the healthy kids.
Well, I give you, it just came to light 2 days ago. A friend of mine sent me some information from the grains and or the breakfast cereal manufacturers in Australia. You know, it's an industry. And basically some information came to me where they've actually, they employ certain dietitians and certain mouthpieces to promote and get their stories saying that we need to be eating cereal, we need to be eating whole grains, we need, you know, the story. Mm-hmm. And I was listed in there as the potential threat, and others saying we need to basically discredit these people mm-hmm. from that are promoting a lower carb or paleo mm-hmm. or ketogenic approach. Mm-hmm. So they've been doing this for years. So it's just to protect their industry from what I understand. But ethically, how do the dietitians and doctors that you deal with or that you know of, why do they keep spreading the same information? Is it because they're uneducated or they don't want to admit that maybe the information they learnt was wrong? Or what's going to be the turning point for them, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I can't understand the motivations. I mean, I'll debate anybody on the planet on this topic, because it would be a nonstop victory debate for me. You're feeding kids healthy food and you're preventing diabetic complications. And the standard that's being pushed by the dietitians, we know, look, I'll give you one example. There's an Australian endocrinologist. She published a paper recently, trying to use the standard carb counting formula techniques. And what did she show? She showed that the blood sugars were roller coaster, that they were significantly higher. The amount of time that you'd spend more than double normal was a huge percentage of the time. Not only that, you'd get some significant amounts of hypoglycemia. But then what do they do with this information? They just, the next week or so, they're pushing high carb cookbooks for type 1 kids. I don't know what is going on with these people. Did they study nutrition and physiology and become physicians or dietitians just to push agony on people? At some point, they're going to have to realize that the textbooks that they learn from are incorrect. I just can't understand the motivations. You hit on the big possible motivation, which is this very dark force of industry funding dietitians and to do things. And that's been well established in the New York Times. And the story on that is definitely getting out. But, you know, now that you're seeing these positive results, like in our pediatrics paper, where kids are, for the first time, type 1 kids are able to run normal blood sugars by eating healthy foods, which we know are micronutrient replete, the right number of micronutrients that have sufficient amounts of protein. Why are they continuing to push the foods that they push? It's unbelievable to me.
Mm, and unethical. And this has been such a wonderful podcast, and I really appreciate you sharing all this information and your story of your whole family, and I guess the future is looking brighter than it was for you 5 years ago, because you have created this community of, and also getting these papers published. So where do you see this movement in 5, 10, 15 years time?
Man, I don't know. That's a really good question. I have to think about that. My primary goal was to sort of spread Dave's message. It was also, after I became friends with Dr. Bernstein, the book is strong enough. I mean, it's a big book, you know, it'll build the mind and body if you carry that book around. But if you talk to him, there's 10 books that he hasn't written. And so what I've been doing with him is recording all on YouTube. If you go to YouTube, there's Diabetes University, which is his YouTube channel. We have over 150 videos of him just talking about all the topics of diabetes. So I wanted to get, you know, he's 84. He's going to retire one day, maybe. It doesn't look like it, actually. But I wanted to get everything out of his mind and recorded. And I wanted to get Dave's story out. And then the story bloomed and we got this research paper out there. So, maybe now it's time to kind of think, okay, what's next? I don't know the answer.
Well, I do have one question for you before we wrap it up, or two questions. We've talked about type 1 diabetes, and it's so important what you're sharing. But in Australia, we have close to 2 million people, which is nearly 10% of the population at this particular point in time in history, that have type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And you said most of that can be reversed.
Absolutely. In fact, I would say that your 10% is a total underestimate, because the guidelines and thresholds used to diagnose type 2 are arbitrary and very high. When you take someone who's pre-diabetic with an A1C of, say, 5.8%, they've already lost control of the ability to control their blood sugars. We know that diabetic complications occur at those kinds of blood sugars. So to call that person pre-diabetic, to me, that person's already grossly diabetic. So that 10% number, and that's kind of a number that's here in the U.S. too. It's much worse. Sorry to be gloomy. It's a much worse situation. But we know what to do to relieve it. And the principles have been laid out in the Bernstein book for decades. For a type 2 diabetic, removing the insulin resistance is the important thing to do. And the biggest thing you can do right off the bat to reduce your insulin resistance is to lose weight, exercise, and most importantly, dramatically drop your carbohydrate intake. If you do those three things, your blood sugar is going to come back to normal. Now, if you keep building fat and eating carbohydrate, causing your insulin levels to go high and your blood sugar levels to go high, eventually because glucose is toxic to beta cells, your ability to produce insulin will eventually wane, and then you will become an insulin dependent type 2 diabetic. And that's entirely a preventable situation.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to finish off with you've been on this roller coaster of a journey for so long now, and it's smoothing out for you. You don't have those huge highs and lows, I guess.
That's right.
But I often ask my guests, what is the one ingredient that you would love to share for your own recipe for life that you've discovered along the way? Something that our listeners may resonate with.
I have to stay on the topic of type 1 diabetes. The thing about type 1 diabetes is that if we had listened to the doctors and dietitians and the materials produced by the insulin manufacturers and the professional diabetes associations, my son would already be well along the way of going straight down the tubes. He was, the other day, went to the eye doctor. He has an annual eye doctor appointment. And the eye doctor looked at his retina. He said, nothing, perfect. And how long has he had diabetes? I said, 5 years. He said, wow, that's great. You know, are you keeping his blood sugars good? I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, how fast do you see signs when you look at kids? He goes, oh, we see it right after diagnosis.
Hmm.
So my advice to people with type 1 diabetes or diabetes in general is that what you're being taught by your medical team is not a strategy for long-term survival. It's a strategy for you to develop diabetic complications via chronic roller coaster blood sugars. And you better figure that out fast, and you better learn how to normalize your blood sugars. And there's enough information out there from the Bernstein videos and the Bernstein book, and our pediatrics paper proves this is the right way to go now. You better figure out how to normalize your blood sugar. If you rely on your dietitian, in almost all cases, you're going to be running blood sugars. I think the average A1C is close to triple normal what a non-diabetic runs. So self-education, let's say that, is my message. If you rely on someone else to help you normalize your blood sugars, you're going to be in for some significant agony. So I would say figure out how to properly control your blood sugars, and that starts with eating a low-carbohydrate diet.
And self-education. I love it.
Self-education. Yeah.
And speaking of the people that are actually getting results, mm-hmm. sustainable long-term results. RD, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast, Recipes for Life. It has been an absolute joy having you share your wisdom. We love you, and I look forward to wherever this may take you and your family and the rest of the community that is looking for answers. Thank you so much, brother.
Okay. Aloha, Pete. Thank you very much.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.